We're continuing today to work through Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. For the last couple of weeks, we've been working through a section of Jesus' teaching that begins with an acknowledgement of what the law of Moses taught, and then continues with Jesus taking that teaching and saying, "But I say to you," moves well beyond the letter of the law into a way of acting that's rooted in love rather than law. We're going to continue in that in the next parts of the sermon. They are found in Matthew chapter 5, 33 to 42. In this part of Jesus' teaching, we find two more ways that Jesus unpacks the law and works it out in ways that are much deeper and more profound. Let's start by reading the text, Matthew chapter 5, 33 to 42. Actually, before I do that, I'm going to pray one more time. God, I ask that as we open up Scripture and explore the teaching of Jesus, that you would help us to understand it a little more fully, give us an openness to be figuring out how this works itself out in our lives. God, thank you that you invite us into a way that is much deeper and more profound than simply following rules. Help us to learn from this how to love more fully in the way of Jesus. Amen. Matthew 5, 33 to 42. Again, you've heard that it was said to the people long ago, "Do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. You've heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to one who asks you, do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you." Each of these sections, verses 33 to 37 and then 38 to 42, begins with a legal context that's covered in the Torah, the Old Testament law. The first has to do with legally binding oaths, trying to convince people that what you're saying is true. Now, if you're in the Facebook chat, I don't know if I'm going to be able to see your responses. If you text them, I will hopefully be able to see them. But I would love to hear from you. What are some ways that we try to convince people that what we are saying is true? So maybe things that we would swear, or how we would try to convince people, no, it's true. Honestly, what are some ways in our world and our culture, and what are some contexts where it's really important that we find a way to convince somebody it's true? Maybe some legal ways, because this has to do with legally binding oaths. The Old Testament has a number of passages that deal with binding oaths. One is Leviticus 19:12, where God's people are instructed, "Do not swear falsely by my name and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." Oaths were a part of the world. Oaths before God were a part of their world. And God wanted to make sure that when somebody swore in his name, that they didn't do it falsely, that they actually honored their oath. In Deuteronomy, a very similar passage really emphasizes how guilty someone was if they didn't fulfill their oath before God. Because of how seriously vows before God were taken by Israel, these absolute binding oaths were something that people tried to avoid. They were only used in the most extreme situations because of how serious it was. To avoid potential guilt, but still to put extra weight in their words, what they did was they developed a hierarchy of oaths. And we see that reflected here in the text. You know, if they wanted to make sure it's important, but they don't want to swear before God because then they get guilty, then they might swear before heaven, because that's where God is, but it's not God himself. And then something a little bit less important, you see it reflected in the text, earth, then Jerusalem, then one's own head. Each one of these gets a little bit farther away from God specifically, and it seems that they would use this kind of scale depending on how important the issue was or how emphatically they wanted to convince someone of the seriousness of their vow. Jesus hears this attempt to emphasize when someone is telling the truth, first of all, and points out how, since everything is from God, heaven is his throne, earth is his footstool, Jerusalem as his city, and one's own head is the handiwork of God, that he controls whether even the hairs are white and black. See, this is his fault. They swear on anything, that to swear on anything is to swear against God. Instead, Jesus invites us into a radically different ethic. Now, I'm just wondering if there's any comments there. I can't really see them. Is there any comments there that how we tend to try and convince people that things are true? Nope, not seeing it. Anyway, hopefully you're interacting in the comments. But Jesus invites us into a radically different ethic, one of simple truth-telling. You see, a culture of oath-taking, trying to convince people that, you know, this time you will or you are being true to your word, is a culture where not being true to your word is normal. The law of Moses observed this and made accommodation for it by insisting there were consequences if you made a vow and then broke it. Jesus observed this and insisted that making vows simply perpetuates this idea that truth isn't our normal expectation. He insists that his followers should be men and women who live out a new normal. Truth. Not just in scenarios that were governed by the law, as in oaths, but in every situation. In the process of leading people beyond Moses, Jesus has been gradually striking back against things that exert power over people and dehumanize them. It started with murder and has gradually been working through ways of dehumanization and showing power that are maybe a little bit more accessible to us. Because we read about murder and we're like, yeah, but we don't do that. And then he gets to adultery and it's like, well, no, we don't. Most of us don't do that either. And it kind of works its way things to more accessible things, when things we can relate to a little bit more. Each time he does that, he calls us into something more. So first, murder comes about because we embrace the brokenness of our world. We don't even try for reconciliation, but Jesus instead calls us to pursue peace and reconciliation. Adultery comes about because we embrace seeing each other as means to our pleasure, something that can just meet our need for pleasure. Instead, Jesus calls us to see others as so valuable that we would rather be humiliated than to see them treated as objects. The divorce Jesus is addressing comes about because we see relationships as expendable. Instead, Jesus invites us to radical and lifelong commitment, barring the most extreme betrayal. And finally here, the taking of oaths is only necessary because we don't see others as worthy of the truth at all times. Instead, Jesus invites us to a life of complete honesty, seeing others as worthy of our truth and integrity, letting our yes be yes and our no be no. And from there, Jesus moves into a way that we act towards others. Well, this next section, it isn't just something that's allowed by the law. It's actually commanded by the law. Jesus quotes something that's found in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy when he says, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. There's a command in the Old Testament for something that's called retributive justice. Retributive justice is the idea that punishment someone must endure is going to be equal to the crime they committed. It's made clear in Leviticus 24. It says this: anyone who injures their neighbor is to be injured in the same manner. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. The one who has inflicted the injury must suffer the same thing. You know, in some ways, this idea of retributive justice, it would be a gift. It would prevent someone from going above and beyond in the pursuit of vengeance. It's easy if you've done something to me and I go do something back for it to spiral out of control quickly. And this sets limits on punishments to ensure that they never went beyond the crime in question. But within the law, there was no exceptions to retributive justice. Not only did the Old Testament retributive justice limit the punishment to fit the crime, it demanded that it was strong enough to fit the crime. In the Deuteronomy passage where it talks about eye for eye and tooth for tooth, it says this. It says, show no pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. You see that? They're supposed to show no pity. There's not supposed to be any exceptions to this law. Now, over time, the teachers of the law worked this system out by figuring out how they could replace the foot for foot by you have to pay a certain amount of money that's the equivalent of the foot. And so they monetized this, but the basic principle was the same. Retributive justice. The humiliation and justice that was caused to one person must be caused to the one who must be done to the one who caused the harm in the first place in order for the scales of justice to balance. The law says if you've dehumanized someone else by the evil you've done to them, then the best thing to happen to restore humanity is to bring the one who's done the wrong down to the same level. But Jesus says, don't resist an evil person. Then he calls us to consider ourselves in four scenarios that help us to understand exactly how this works out in the Jesus way. What really reflects the heart of God? The first situation is that someone slaps you on your right cheek. In the right-hand dominant world, the slap on the right cheek means that you've just been hit with a backhand slap from another. It wasn't just an act of violence. It was an act of dominance and demeaning. The second is that someone sued you for your shirt. Now, legally, this was the most that someone could possibly take from the other. And in this time, people wore two layers of clothes. There was the outer robe, called in this passage the coat, and the inner robe, called the shirt. The coat was used as a blanket and covering at night and was considered essential for survival. And so the law forbade it from being taken from another. But the shirt, which was underneath, that could be taken. Basically, to sue someone for their shirt is to take everything they legally could from the other, leaving them destitute. The third situation is that of a Roman soldier conscripting someone to carry them or their equipment for a mile. It says, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. That idea of being forced to go 1 mile is taken from the law that allowed a Roman soldier to conscript you into their service. This act of dominance and power over the other was completely legal in Jesus' world. It would have been despised by those who were being occupied, but it was fully legal. In these three examples, the listener or reader is asked to put themselves in a situation where someone else is using their power to humiliate or dehumanize you. The other is acting with evil, and Jesus is calling us to think about how we respond. The law of retributive justice says that our longing and God's heart should be for them to suffer the same dehumanization and humiliation that we cause, that has been done to us. But instead of setting our hearts towards the suffering of others, Jesus invites us into something radically different. He invites us into a way of responding that subverts the law that allowed them to demean us and subverts the entire expectation that things will be more just if I can just make them suffer too. If I can just make them suffer the same way. You know, you've just received the backhand slap that put you down. Jesus suggests offering the other cheek too. In offering the other cheek, you're first of all asserting your own worth and value as an equal person. They're demeaning you, and you are standing up and saying, I am not something that is less than you. I am an equal person. You don't roll over. You look them in the eye as a fellow person. But this act also invites them to see you as an equal person. You're not someone to be demeaned, but on the same level. If they're going to hit you again, they can't do it with the backhand demeaning slap. They have to do it as one who is equal. And in so, they are actually elevating their view of you. Finally, in turning your other cheek, you honor the humanity in them. You're not choosing to try and make them suffer and thereby be dishonored in the pursuit of making things better for you. Turning the other cheek not only challenges the person standing in front of you, it challenges the entire system of our world that feeds a cycle of dehumanization. I have this conversation with kids, and they understand that if I get punched in the eye and I've got a black eye, I haven't actually made anything better if I punch somebody back. All that happens is two people in the world now have black eyes. You know, this cycle, these three things, asserting your value, inviting the other to recognize your value, and honoring the value of the other, the same holds true in the court scene that comes next. Someone has dehumanized you by taking all they legally can, so you respond by giving them everything you have. In this case, you exert your humanity by actually turning yourself towards them in generosity. You invite them to see your humanity through your response. In this situation, quite fully, to see your full humanity. And you honor theirs by essentially saying, if you're in such need that you need my shirt, please take my coat too. You're honoring their humanity even while they dishonor yours. In responding to the Roman soldier who grabs you and uses his force, his power to force you into labor by forcing you to carry his stuff a mile, by offering to carry things for another mile, it exerts your humanity by making this about your free choice. It invites them to acknowledge yours by walking alongside you now as equal people, and it honors theirs by remaining with them and assisting them for another mile. Can't imagine how the conversation would change over that second mile than it did, than what it looked like over the first. Then there's a fourth situation, a final situation. And this is one in which somebody simply asks you for something. This last one flips the power dynamic on its head. The idea is one of a beggar calling out, asking for help. Now you're the one with the power. And Jesus causes us to ask and consider, will you honor yourself and the other through your response, or will you use that power in other ways? To hold it over them, to dehumanize them in some way. The generosity Jesus calls for invites us to live in a way that undoes those systems of power and control over others by giving freely. The tendency in our world is to use our words and our actions as means of exerting power over others, or fighting against those others who exert power over us. Jesus invites us into speaking and acting in ways that honor the humanity of both ourselves and others, even when they are acting in ways that are evil. We're called to speak and act in ways that leave people sure that what they see from us is truth, and to respond to evil in such a way that it invites evildoers into a way of being that moves away from conflict and towards empathy, away from confrontation towards cooperation, away from dogmatic monologue towards a dialogue of equals. I want to close by sharing a short story with you. Bob Goff tells this story in his book, Love Does for Kids. Every night as I lay Joe into bed, we've been listening through this. And this one actually came up last night. When his two sons were in middle school, some kids in his community got into TP wars, toilet paper wars. A few times over a couple of months, his family would walk outside and see their trees and bushes in their front yard just covered with toilet paper. His kids thought it was hilarious, and despite the work it took to clean up, Bob knew that the kids who did it didn't mean any significant harm. It was just a prank. And as a result, he thought it was pretty funny too. Until one night, a group of kids came to TP their yard and decided to take it a little bit further. There was construction happening on part of the house, and the construction company had a porta potty set up outside near the driveway. The kids who TP'd the house thought it would be funny to tip over the porta potty. And you can imagine the mess that it caused all over the driveway. They were pretty sure that they knew the kids that had done it and where they had spent the night before. So when they woke up and saw the mess, Bob called the father at the home where the boys were. The father immediately loaded up the boys and drove them over to see the mess. They didn't realize it was going to make such a huge mess. They were really, really sorry, and they were really, really scared as Bob walked out the front door to meet them. They stood with their heads down, waiting for Bob to berate them for the damage they'd done. But Bob chose not to do that. He knew that Jesus called us to act differently towards those who wronged us. Instead, he began to talk with them as his wife left in the car on an errand. He talked with the boys about how they were becoming men, and as men they had a chance to learn and show their character through their actions. He then invited them to join him and his boys in the cleanup of the mess. The boys all apologized, and together they joined in the cleanup. Just as they finished cleaning up the driveway, the boys, Bob's sons, just as they finished, Bob's wife got home with a pile of fancy donuts. She pulled in and asked, "Who's ready for breakfast?" They all washed up and gathered on the deck to eat donuts and orange juice. Bob said that after that day, his sons and his boys were closer than they'd ever been before, and the boys who pulled that prank never did anything like it again. By honoring himself, inviting others to honor him, and showing honor to the boys, even when they'd done wrong to him, he showed them the way of Jesus, and it led to a change in them. As we go through this week, let's consider how we can fight against a culture of falsehood and revenge. A culture that thinks we can only make things better by manipulating our words or pushing back against those who try to do harm to us. We don't want to bring them down to the same wrong we've received. The heart of God is that we would respond to wrong by showing others the love of Jesus, even when the world around us is calling for something different.